from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thank you to Johnny B and Emma Power for entertaining us this afternoon. It is Monday the 10th of July and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, we reflect on a big weekend at Croke Park that sees Limerick and Kilkenny reach the All-Ireland Hurling Final again.
Hugh Lawler's there fumbling with it for Kilkenny. Like a phase of rugby, they're waiting for the ball to emerge and it breaks clear's way. They're coming trouble. It's whipped on by Duggan, stopped by the keeper. It's still alive. Back out it comes over to Dearman Ryan. Ryan firing it in over the bar. It goes. It's a point for Clare. A frantic finish.
I'm not sure, Parrott, did that hit the crossbar? I think it might have been a Mon Murphy got a touch and it may have hit the crossbar. Came back out. It was a first time pull. Duggan, he pulled on it. First time it goes in. Murphy gets the slightest touch and bang, hits the flat spot on the crossbar. That's what you can hear from the crowd here. What a save by Owen Murphy. We're even.
Oh, some things had to be seen to be believed, and we'll have more on that save shortly with Niall Moran. But in rugby, we've Bernard Jackman and Ireland's under-20s making the World Cup final. And in soccer, we've Alan Cawley as United hunt for a new goalkeeper. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there. Good evening. Welcome along to Game On. Myself, Shane Dawson, Ruby Walsh, Alan Cawley and Bernard Jackman are all in studio. Packed studio it is to reflect on a big weekend of sport. But before we do, Ruby, a couple of news headlines just to rattle through. At Wimbledon, Novak Djokovic is through to the quarterfinals after defeating Hubert Hurkacz by 3-1. Third seed Daniel Medvedev is into his maiden Wimbledon quarterfinal after his Czech opponent Jiří Leeka retired after the first two sets. Fifth seed Stefanos Tsitsipas was knocked out of Wimbledon by Chris Eubanks, who sets up a USA versus Russia quarterfinal with the aforementioned Medvedev. In the women's side of the draw, Madison Keys came from a set and four games to one down against teenager Mira Andreeva to win in three sets. Andreeva was given a point penalty for throwing her racket and she also refused to shake the umpire's hand. Elena Rybakina has advanced after Brazilian 13 seed Beatriz Haddad-Maia was forced to retire through injury in the first set. Second seed Aryna Sabalenka went through in straight sets, as did 6 seed Ons Jabeur. Alan Cawley will be delighted with Chris Eubanks going through.
We did mention him the other day, Shane. You're a only knockout blow on another one today.
You're only talking him up at the weekend. Two other small bits of news. Lahinch Golf Club will stage the 51st Walker Cup in September 2026. Will be just the third time that the men's amateur event featuring Britain and Ireland against the USA will be staged in Ireland. And former Galway United and Dundalk manager Ian Foster is leaving his current role as England under-20s boss to become Steven Gerrard's assistant at Saudi Arabian club Al Ittihad. So
he once managed me, Ian Foster.
Oh yeah?
I never thought he'd end up over in Saudi Arabia as an understudy to Steven Gerrard. That's something I didn't think I'd ever hear on a Monday evening at 2FM.
Has he been in touch, you know, Alan Cawley, SOC coach maybe?
No, well, I've dropped him the odd message here and there over the years because he went on to do good things with the English FA and
Very much so.
He managed the European Championships. Was it the under-19 team that won the European Championships there a couple of years back? And he's been involved with the English FA for the past 6 years. And I actually saw a message he posted today saying that he's finishing up, but he never mentioned where he was going. So you've just broken that to me there, Shane.
You're live on radio, so text him, ask him, is he going? And is Wilfred Zaha going as well?
Right, yeah. I'm going to find out for you.
Yeah, there you
That's
go.
You have an hour to do that.
Yeah. Be good if you do something constructive for you.
Ruby, while we're on news, it was a good weekend for Aidan O'Brien.
Yeah, Paddington won the Eclipse at Sandown Park on Saturday afternoon, beat Emily Upjohn in a thrilling finish. Only 4 runners, Shane, but it was a brilliant horse race to watch. Paddington ended up in front 2 down and Emily Upjohn came at him, but Paddington stepping up in trip up by 2 furlongs after winning the James's Palace and the Irish 2000 Guineas, had too much in the tank for the English filly. It was a great race to watch. Great race to watch. 2 brilliant riders, Ryan Moore and William Buick, and 2 wonderful horses, and they went toe-to-toe.
We will be chatting rugby with Bernard Jackman, but before we do, was that your sporting highlight? Let's do the rounds, Ruby. Was that the sporting highlight for you from the weekend or what?
Watching sport, yeah. On a personal note, though, I was in the UK with the Irish Pony Club. My daughter was riding on an Irish Pony Club team, and the Irish teams were first, second and third. So on a personal note, that was my sporting highlight for the weekend. You talk about volunteers in every sport, but the Irish Pony Club were so lucky to have a man called John Flood, who has managed the tetrathlon side of things for years, produced athletes such as Natalia Coyle. There's a pentathlon team in Switzerland at the weekend, modern pentathlon. 4 of those came through the Pony Club. 4 lads are going out there. So John Flood does incredible work, and the Pony Club would be lost without him. So on a personal note, that was my highlight.
Absolutely. Well, very well done.
Very well done to all the family.
What about yours, Shane? Can't go back to Friday night now beating UCD 4-0.
Well, on a personal note, Ruby.
And he was actually very nervous. You want to hear it here on Friday evening, Ruby.
Listen, UCD are already gone back down. You can't have been nervous.
We made hard work of it. Made hard work of it.
I stopped
it. No, that was... that was up there. It's nice to enjoy a win watching Shelburne. Owen Murphy save at the weekend. I know we'll be chatting to Niall Moran about it, considering my family ties in Kilkenny, so it's nice to see them go forward. But also, gentlemen, I do have to bring this to servant's attention. Have we seen the Roscommon GAA sheep fiasco?
This is
a highlight for some. So County GAA board is considering updating its crest after discovering the emblem featured the wrong breed of sheep. So Roscommon GAA County Board Chairman Brian Carroll sought advice from the local authority on how they should go about removing the rogue black and white headed sheep from its crest, because as we all know, the traditional Roscommon sheep is white faced with a heavy wavy fleece.
So how exactly, you say we all know. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Ask him, will you, how exactly that's a sporting highlight? If you can explain that in the next hour, that will also be very productive from you.
Okay, that's fine, Ruby. Well, I enjoy the aesthetics of sport. You know, new jerseys coming out. I'm interested in crests, you know.
So your highlight is the wrong crest in a Roscommon football
game. Highlight is something that caught me eye. It's a highlight. I was highlighted by it. It was a good, right, it was a good news
Jackman,
story.
Please,
I'm going back to sporting action.
Highlight, will
action. For me, it was Cape Town yesterday. Ireland convincingly beating South Africa. Obviously, the home nation in the under-20s World Cup semi-final, getting into our third final. Won convincingly on the scoreboard. If you watched that first half, you wouldn't have thought the game would end up the way it did. South Africa were very dominant in terms of possession and territory, but Ireland defended incredibly well and now sets up an all Six Nations final against France on Friday. So this team have been through a lot, and they continue to catch the eye in terms of how their talent but also their character.
Absolutely. I was watching that, to be fair, I was working over the weekend. So they went in a half time 7-0 up, a try late on, although Dermot Mangan could have just inches away from scoring a try as well. But to be able to take that assault really in the first half and to grind out that, to go in ahead and then to score three more tries and, you know, finish in a bit of style as well is some performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we spotted these lads in the Six Nations. They won the Grand Slam. But this was another test against the Southern Hemisphere best, away from home in the Southern Hemisphere. And yeah, it's come back to, you know, the final. The semi-finalists were made up of three teams from the Six Nations: England, France, Ireland and South Africa. And South Africa have historically been very strong at this level, big physical side. But yeah, we were excellent. And you know, Friday will be a different test. This French team are very strong. 14 of them have played top 14 rugby this season. 5 of them have played Pro D2, so they have more experience than this Irish group. Only a couple of our lads have tasted professional rugby, you know, Sam Prendergast and a couple of others. But the way they're playing, they will be underdogs, but you wouldn't back against them.
Say at the weekend, obviously Henry Shefflin sent Cooney out to follow Keane Lynch around Croke Park. Can Richie Murphy send anybody out to man Mark Tuilagi?
No, not really, but certainly he'll be someone they'll talk about this week. And he's been so destructive. I saw him play a little bit this year for Perpignan. His father ended up playing for Perpignan. Obviously the Tuilagi family, you know, very famous in Leicester and England, and he's a nephew of Manu Tuilagi. He's kind of like Will Skelton in terms of size. He's 134 kilos, but he's having a massive impact on this competition. So Ireland won't be able to man mark him. They use him a little bit, they will, in terms of how they use him off front peels and things like that. They'll be very aware of that. But no, it's a case of getting two men in and probably two men low. So traditionally in rugby, you know, you go one low, one high, but this fella is so big and powerful, you need to nearly send two lads low and risk the offload to try and stop him. Yeah, one leg each. Yeah, it's one very low, and then so one guy around the shins and one around the quads, to try and stop momentum, because he's very good at getting that second impact in his carry and shrugging people off. And when he does get that go forward, then France are electric. So they're very different than South Africa. South Africa were very one dimensional but very powerful, whereas France have a nice, very like the senior team, They've got a lot of speed, pace, and ability to keep the ball alive in contact. So it's a completely different challenge than what we faced against South Africa. But this team, you know, they're on a very good run, and they'll relish the opportunity to be the first Irish team to try and win a World Cup.
They are on a great run, and Sam Prendergast has found his form. He was being harsh on him to say he was out of form early in the tournament, but he is starting to peak as this tournament goes forward.
Yeah, he is. And he, look, at even when he's not, even when he hasn't been kind of dominating the game like we're used to seeing him in earlier on in the season, he's having moments, you know. So even yesterday, you know, his kick pass for the try was a touch of class, and he will relish this opportunity. He's packing for, like yesterday, the South African pack were on top for that first half, so he didn't really have much ball to play with. But I think you kind of learn a little more about these lads when they don't have it all their own way. And as you said, Ruby, he's kind of peaking at the right time in this competition. And you know, if Ireland are to win this Friday, you know, you'd imagine that he will have to have a big game. And based on what we've seen from what we hear about him, you would back him to do that.
Go on, Shane. I'll ask Bernard the question. How likely are most of this team then, this Irish team, when you look at how they developed, their Six Nations win, how far they've gone in the World Cup, how many of them will get professional contracts out of this? We know Sam has, but some of the others don't.
Yeah, in a normal year, you're looking at about three or four making it to be professional, but I would say this is an above average crop by a long way, and there's, you know, the hooker Gus McCarthy's captain, he's really impressed, and obviously the Leinster depth chart is pretty strong there, but there's other places he can go to play. Paddy McCarthy, the tight head prop who's moved across to Loosehead, Joe McCarthy's brother, who's in the senior squad, he's been incredibly impressive. Gleeson, the number 8, he's back underage next year. I mean, when you think Munster, you know, 12 months ago people were writing them off forever and wondering whether they're going to get back. Suddenly now they've won a trophy, they've got some young players like Casey and Hodnett, etc., coming through. And then you look at that Irish under-20s team with Ruan Quinn, Gleeson in the back row alone. Like, I'd be surprised if both of those don't go and have really strong professional careers. So and then obviously Fintan Gunn, McAleen, look at there's Gavin from Connacht. There could be 10 or 12 of these lads who are, you know, playing URC for the provinces in 4 or 5 years' time and having 50, 60 caps, you know?
When you look at it, though, it is amazing. So that's a couple of lads on an under-20s team. When you look at the English team that won the under-21 European Championships at the weekend, you had Emil Smith-Rowe, Jacob Ramsey, Lee Cole, Curtis Jones, Harvey Elliott, Anthony Gordon, James Trafford, Morgan Gibbs-White, all playing in the Premier League, all already professionals. How come our under-20s don't have professional contracts in rugby?
It's just the way we develop them here. And it probably suits the Irish system because we can keep them on relatively low contracts until they're 21, 22. So effectively, you know, normally when a player gets an academy contract, it's a 3-year contract and roughly around 5, 10, 15, year 1, year 2, year 3, which brings them up to 22 usually. And then they have they go into the senior contract. So, but there's no competition. Like those English kids, I'd imagine, who, you know, if they weren't getting professional contracts or getting game time, their agents will be trying to, and maybe it's changed a little bit with Brexit, but there's opportunities everywhere. Whereas in Ireland, it's quite closed shop, and the IRFU don't, I suppose, encourage poaching, you know. So Connacht aren't allowed to come in and try and get the best 19-year-old who's based in Dublin out of there
by offering him a huge contract.
It's
when does that come into play then?
After 20. So basically Leinster were, to be honest, historically the majority of the players have come through. Now there's some brilliant players from other provinces in this team, but the majority of the squad are from Leinster. They have until usually around March, I'm not 100% sure on the date, but say March, April of that 20s year to decide if they're going to contract for the academy. So normally they contract around 5 or 6, okay? And after that then, when they made that decision, the other provinces are allowed to come in and offer the others, right? So the players technically shouldn't get lost, right? But the provinces are protected to a certain extent. There's no official rule on this, but this is the way it plays out until they make a decision around the player at around 19 or 20.
But do you see, Bernard, a case of you look at the senior team and how successful they are at the moment, and now you mentioned this group under 20 about to win maybe a World Cup as well, and normally your answer to Ruby was 3 or 4 lads might come through.
Yeah.
Now you're saying 12 or 13. Will it ever get to a stage, the more successful they get, you just can't hold these lads back any longer? Yeah, start my looking abroad.
Yeah, but see, the market abroad is goosed as well. Yeah. You know, so the game has never been in such a poor place. London Irish went about 3 weeks ago. There's hundreds of professional players, there's probably 200 professional players who have decent experience, you know, good CVs, or 24, 25, physically stronger than these lads who can't get jobs, you know. So, and also, if you look at it, if like Connacht have qualified for the European Cup, Ulster, Munster have won URC, Leinster got to a final, the provinces in Ireland are in good shape as well. And you know, when you're in good shape, you're less likely to be desperate to find, you know, to contract a young fella. So these kids tend to be patient, they stay in the system, and the good ones rise to the top anyway. So it's not comparable to probably, you know, jockeys or soccer, where there's a much bigger marketplace and people are hungry to get the next big
thing.
Much cutthroat, yeah. There's a little bit of, and also the kids themselves, you know, the kids from Leinster want to try and make it in Leinster first. The kid from Munster, that's where they came from, they want to play for Munster, so they're less likely to jump ship until they're sure they can't make it in their own province.
But you look down at the international cap base, Bernard, say, of the All Blacks, a little bit maybe, but even England compared to Ireland or say Wales, like we have several people who get who've been capped over 100 times. Yep. Same in Wales, like Alwyn Jones, about 150 odd caps or whatever it is. Whereas England and the All Blacks, very few of their players get as many caps because they keep bringing in the younger lads.
Yeah, they do. They do. England's probably a little bit different in that there's been a bit of turmoil in terms of coaching and so many different clubs, and Eddie Jones in particular was an awful man for chopping and changing. You know, he didn't settle on anything. New Zealand, I would say the reason New Zealand there isn't as many fellas getting as many caps is they tend to go chase the dollar or chase the euro or chase the yen a little bit later in their career. So where either they leave and go to play in the top 14 and get double the money, or they also have this thing where they give players a sabbatical. So for example, the likes of Dan Carter, Beauden Barrett, they know they can't compete with the Japanese clubs or the French clubs, but the lure of being an All Black and going to a World Cup is big enough to keep them there for 3 of the 4 seasons in a World Cup cycle. So they'll go for a year and miss out on international selections. So that's probably, whereas in Ireland, to be honest, the IRFU pay quite very well, and then there's the tax back, and then there's the fact you're playing for the team the province that you're from. Most the four provinces all believe they can win silverware. The medical side of things is good. There's longevity, etc. So players are less likely to leave Ireland or Wales. Wales is a little bit different, but I won't cover them tonight. But the players are less likely to leave Ireland because of the environment we have here than the Southern Hemisphere teams. Players who tend to want to go to Europe or Japan to financially capitalise on the biggest contracts.
So the system suits Ireland. You wouldn't change anything about it, or would you tweak a few things in there?
Okay, I think that we may be the only look at this. Obviously, suits Ireland. We're number one in the world. Our 20s are in a World Cup final and are Grand Slam winners. But I would say the only change I would make is having somebody there to try and get some of those young players who are blocked. You know, maybe 6 months experience somewhere else, you know. Loan deals, yeah. I think that would be for example, like Gus McCarthy, he's contracted at Leinster Academy. You know, you've got Dan Sheehan, Ronan Kelleher, and a couple of other fellas ahead of him. You know, could we really see how good he is by moving him to the Premiership for 6 months to cover an injury? Like in France, there's medical jokers needed during the year. That's the only thing I would tinker with. But then I know that Leo Cullen and Graham Rowntree would say, well, what happens if I get a few injuries? I'll need those players. So
the system work though, Bernard, because you're all singing off the same hymn sheet and pulling in the same direction, whereas we might look at football and compare it, and it's just fractured left, right, yeah, and centre, because everybody's in it for themselves or their own kind of agenda, if you like.
Yeah, look at provincial coaches are allowed to do their own thing to a certain extent, but there's a strong alignment. There's alignment to the IRFU. There's alignment between what Andy Farrell wants to the players to do on a weekly basis to get into his team. So everything is very much dear towards Ireland, and you only have four teams to control, whereas the Premiership in rugby even, you know, has gone from 12 to 10. But you imagine trying to control 10 coaches and trying to control the recruitment, the retention. That's why France is a good example of a country that wasn't aligned, and the national team really suffered. They realised that they're going to have a home World Cup and they want to do well at that, and that focused the mind and basically got the clubs to understand the importance of developing young French players, and they financially paid them to do that, and now suddenly they've gone to be number two in the world, and a strong chance to win a World Cup, and maybe they'll win a World Cup on Friday with under 20. So we're probably the two countries who are the most aligned at the moment, and ironically New Zealand, who we always were envious of and were aligned, their under 20s this year were very, very average. And that's another story. The problem over there is the whole concussion thing issue is starting to affect the numbers playing the game at youth level in schools, and their production line isn't anywhere near as strong as it was. So, at the moment we're in a purple patch, but these things can change. It's quite cyclical.
One final question before we take an ad break. Fair to say Brian O'Driscoll was one of the greatest Irish players of all time?
Absolutely, yeah. Where's this going?
He was 20 when he scored the hat-trick in Twickenham against England. We have X amount of players in South Africa, some who must be 20. I know they're playing under 20, but that's from the 1st of January. How come we've none of them in the senior squad?
Look, when Brian O'Driscoll broke into that team, Irish rugby was a poor team, to be fair, and so I think that's why.
He was Brian O'Driscoll.
But it's always it's harder to displace a team or people who are doing well. I mean, is he better than like Gary Ringrose? If Brian O'Driscoll's coming through again, and Gary Ringrose, Robbie Henshaw, Bundy Aki were playing, like Brian O'Driscoll played for Ireland before he played for Leinster. It's just things have moved on.
Apples and oranges,
yeah,
Ruby.
Yeah, no, it's no.
I'm only asking the question. There's a World Cup coming up. Should we not?
I know, but the team back then was nowhere near as good.
I don't think there's a Brian O'Driscoll. I hope there is three or four of them, but. At the moment I think the Irish team are in a good place. There's less likelihood of Farrell taking a massive punt, but I absolutely agree with you. I think if they're young enough, you got to throw them in, but I wouldn't replace any of the current team for one of these under 20s at this moment.
Okay, well, debating Andy Farrell's Ireland World Cup squad, I think, is going to be, and the IRFU going from nearly killing off Connacht to needing a fifth province now. Bernard Jackman, thank you as always. Alan, you're sticking around. We're going to be chatting soccer a little bit later, but up next, we're going to be chatting to Niall Horan and all. Not Moran, I should say.
Forget Niall Horan, that'd be great on the golf. That'd
be singing a song as well.
You're going finding out what's going on in Saudi Arabia, and he's going to get Niall Horan for us. This show is a crack.
Stay tuned to Game On here on 2FM.
Game On.
Hurling. Welcome back to Game On. Well, there's very little doubt that the highlight of the weekend was the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Quarter Semi-Finals, even played at Croke Park, and they started on Saturday evening when Limerick beat Galway and finished on Sunday with Kilkenny beat Clare. Niall Moran joins us on the line. Niall, you've been predicting this final for quite a while. Surely you got a few quid over.
Wouldn't quite call myself Nostradamus now, Ruby, but I had a hunch for these two teams to come back into it. I did have a few bob in it, but I think my countrymen mightn't thank me for my money was on. Did I see anything over the weekend that took me or will take me from the final outcome? No. And for when we look at it, Limerick by far and away were far more convincing winners in the manner in which they probably dismantled Galway with 20 minutes to go, the game was over, and Kilkenny do what Kilkenny do, they find a way to win. So I'm sure if the bookies were the odds, I'm sure they're still probably stacked in Limerick's favour, but that's where my hunch comes in, Ruby. I see what Kilkenny do, they always find a way, and so that's one thing. Their DNA plays a huge role in how I feel they're going to be hugely dangerous opposition for Limerick in 2 weeks' time.
Well, in a two-horse race, if you were pricing it, both horses would be 10 to 11 to give the bookmakers an edge. But they're pricing the All-Ireland final 4 to 11, Limerick 3 to 1, Kilkenny. Are they 3 to 1 shots to beat Limerick, Niall?
Not in my book, but I'm sure the bookmakers, they're trying to find a way to money. I think at 10 to 11, it's not very forthright for either team, but at 3 to 1, it might entice a few punters to go after Kilkenny. Look, I suppose if we're to do a synopsis, Anna Ruby, like Limerick against Galway, Galway came fire and brimstone, really well organised. First 25 minutes, Like Limerick, I won't say they look to be in trouble, but a lot of questions have been asked, and Limerick were kind of sluggish, a couple of uncharacteristic wides, probably a huge betting in period given like William O'Donoghue at six. It probably took him that first quarter to bet in, but again, we just saw the wily old fox there, Nicky inside the goals. It was a critical moment in the game. He stalled it for his contact lenses. I'm not sure how long he's these contact lenses in now, to be honest, Ruby, but that kind of change that occurred in those couple of minutes while he was down, it gave Limerick a chance to reorganise, recalibrate, and, you know what I mean, by half-time they were a point down, having been five down, and only for what you consider fortuitous, Mike Casey touched to prevent a goal, they otherwise would have been 8 points down, but just the way in which they dismantled all the way after half-time, like, outscored them in the third quarter, 1-8, 3 points, so even puck out twice, like Galway won 9 out of 20, that's a 45% hit rate, that's not going to get you over the line against an opposition like Limerick. And look, I suppose for Galway going home, went down the motorway on Saturday, I'd say they were crestfallen, because at least last year they went away with a little bit of hope, but the last 20 minutes probably really sucked the hope out of them for us to come, and probably would raise questions in what the makeup of their squad might be come next year, given the age profile that they currently have.
Yeah, Shane McGrath mentioned in our preview on Friday that a defeat for Galway could have long-lasting consequences. Would you be fearful as to what this does for them going forward?
I'm not going to be dramatic. Again, like, I suppose I'm in Galway quite a bit there in recent times, and just speaking to the Galway people in the lead-up to the game, they were massively hopeful. Like, you know what I mean? I suppose they felt that they still had 7 or 8 or 9 guys who won All-Ireland and some very, very good talent coming through. So it's not you're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it was just when physically Limerick just completely dominated them. Look, I equate like this Limerick team as it does everybody else to the Kilkenny team of a decade ago. And so my experience of playing against them was you could always be going in the best of your game, top of your game as a team. You could be going in where you're coming into a huge run of form. I remember our own experience there in 2012 above in Thurles. I think we went in maybe a point up at half time or even just barely a point down, thinking, yeah, we really have them on the rack here now, asking all those questions. And within 10 minutes of the second half, you found yourself playing in a game whereby there was no way out. You were drowning. There was no way to get your hand on the ball. Yet, you might have only been 4 points down and you had a chance, but the game was realistically over. And I felt that was exactly what happened, Galway against Limerick. Limerick just dominated the skies. The game was on, but the game was over. And, I suppose that's a kind of a demoralising thing for Galway. But from Limerick perspective, again, it reinforces, I suppose, the experiences that they have and just their awareness under pressure. Against the E-boys, you're talking to various sports people, be it golf or snooker or athletes or whatever else. And I suppose being in the moment is something that most athletes nowadays really, really reference. And one thing that I notice about Limerick players when they're interviewed, that short window that we get post-game, whereby we do actually get an insight into who they are, it's their ability to critically evaluate what has just gone on in a tempest for the previous 75 minutes. And that is exceptionally hard. Do you know what I mean? I know myself, when you were playing, I couldn't tell you what happened when matches were being played. And I even see it now that when you're getting involved in coaching on the level, you're so invested that like a lot of times 65% of what's just gone on has passed you by because you're trying to put out fires. But these Limerick guys, management and players, they have an ability to synopsize what's just gone on in a really clarified way. And I think if you were to look at the 4 sets of management that took to the pitch in Croke Park last weekend just gone, I definitely think there's 2 sets of managers, and both the losing managers, I think they got lost in that moment. And whereas with the ones that won, they seemed way, way calmer on the line. And that's not being disingenuous to losing managers. Like, they're incredible people, have done incredible jobs over a sustained period with various, various teams. They're as good a people as what you can have in. They've given absolutely everything. But it's in that moment, their ability just to stay calm and stay, you know what I mean, invested in what was relevant. I think both Henry and Brian both lost that, and they paid the price because they weren't able to repair in time some of the holes that were there. Whereas in Derek and John's case, it's incredible their ability to find composure, and that was kind of reflected then in both sets of their players. So that to me ultimately had a huge bearing on it, and both games coming down the home stretch.
But Niall, is that the ability to just react and make a decision? That's what sport's about.
It's just making a decision. I suppose it's being reactive to what's going on in front of you. It's carrying out what you have given excruciating amount of time prior to it. But again, like I suppose the expression that we often heard, the English rugby team that won the World Cup, I don't know, was it Dave Alford, the kicking coach, or whoever came up with it, about the whole idea of teacup, thinking clearly under pressure. And do you know what I mean? There's not a dressing room or a dressing room in any sport in the country that is not aware of it. There's not a manager who's not aware of that concept. But having the ability as a human, a fallible human, amidst an arena of 82 or 3,000 people to actually make these decisions. Like, we're here on Monday. There's countless reams of articles written and spoken about what has just gone on. We're removed from the emotion of us. We're all able to take moral high grounds on what should have been done, what should not have been done. But as a manager, like, do you know what I mean? As a player or a sports person, you both know it, and all your listeners would, that when you invest so much time and energy into something, well, at least when you're a player or an athlete, you get to release that. You can throw those emotions. But a manager probably invests three times as much as that, and they're never given the platform to release that emotion. And ultimately, when they actually do take that opportunity to release it, it can be critical to a team's chance because they may not be aware of what's going on in front of them. And that, to me, was just looking in from both Kilkenny and Limerick's managers. That's an incredible ability. And it's not everybody has that ability. But I know in Limerick's case, Caroline Curtis played a huge part in facilitating that awareness and that staying in the moment for the management. And that's something both losing teams, you know what I mean, they might take note of going forward when they look to find those extra percent.
For John Kiely, it's 5 All-Ireland finals in 7 years in charge, which is just ridiculous numbers. Derek Ling, relatively more inexperienced. And how much credit has to go to Derek? And do you think he's going to be here now for maybe not as long as Brian Cody was in charge, but in terms of for the foreseeable future, Derek's going to be the man for Kilkenny?
He's savage. He went up last year to an All-Ireland under-20 final. Kilkenny team been given no chance. John, the previous year hadn't been too good, and they went and in a kind of game of cat and mouse, they just wore Limerick down with a far lesser team, and John, you know, I mean, tactically a lot more astute than they've been, and they won that All-Ireland, and he's bringing every one of those qualities into this setup. And look, it's no coincidence that he was next man in line. I don't know who's responsible for picking him for that 20th job or whatever else, but he is just so composed, and he has a huge presence. There was one incident there with maybe 20 minutes to go. I actually didn't happen to be at the Limerick game. I'm doing a guard box in the Limerick game for various reasons. I wasn't able to go the first time, missed in a long time, but I was at the Clare Kilkenny game. I really enjoyed it. But there was one incident there 20 minutes just before the end, and I know Brian was kind of in the face and the Clare people, a lot of roaring and shouting. I don't know who went down, I haven't seen the game back, but Derek Lane just stood within 5 yards. He was there as a presence. He wasn't roaring, he wasn't bawling, but he stood and his shadow was there, and you know, his playing credentials automatically give him the right to stand toe-to-toe with anybody. But it was just the way he carried himself. Looked no different to a kind of a lieutenant in the war, but he has that ability. He's calm, he's that little bit more modern, and I think maybe just the affection in which players are openly showing him, and he's openly showing his players, that's probably one of the differences to the Brian Cody era. And look, you see the energy he's getting out of his older guys, and none more so than Owen Murphy, which, you know, what the most incredible reactionary save you will ever see in Croke Park, like, you know.
Is that the greatest hurling save you've seen?
I know Nicky's was. Limerick's was better. look, come here to me. My perception of goalies is they're lads that aren't good enough to play out field, right? But so we'd be often slagging here in the club there that, you know what I mean, if you can't find anywhere else through, we'll put you in goals. But I think, no, look, when you see what Owen has done and what he's done over a number of years, and the irony of it is no different to probably his contemporary Nicky. They're both are arguably amongst the best backs in both their club championships. But it was just, like, there was a body of players in front of him that he was totally unsighted. I know they paid reference to it, but lad, it was just incredible. But again, here's my argument. I deal with the kind of moments that when you reflect on a year that you'll say a team's name was all over a championship. Limerick had something similar in 2018, obviously, with Nicky. So what I mean, the Killian Buckley moment, the what I call the Owen Murphy moment. And I have an eerie sense that
Limerick are coming in, having played very, very well. As you said, Ruby said 3-1 on favourites. Kilkenny scraped over the line. Loads of doubts coming into it. But what people don't realise is that game is worth its weight in gold. Kilkenny, it's in their DNA. And there's two teams in this country that you have to be 5 points better than to beat them by one. One is Limerick, but the other is Kilkenny. And don't think for a moment, just because Limerick are on the crest of a wave and going for four All-Irelands, but that's going to deter Kilkenny any bit. And again, I'm going to reference that All-Ireland final last year above in Thurles. Kilkenny in the stand, I've never seen them as venomous or venomous on the pitch. And much and all, we look forward to an unbelievable battle in Limerick a month ago for a Munster final and build up to it. I'm telling you, there's a war going to take place. And they might need more than just a referee. They might have to get the UN to step in to pull them apart. I think that's really what's going to excite people over the next couple of weeks, because Kilkenny have... They come toe-to-toe at Limerick in league final earlier this year, last year's All-Ireland final. Very little between them last year. This year, I don't think Kilkenny threw their hat at the league final, but it's Custer's last stand. It's the last dance for a number of players there in Kilkenny, and I'm just very wary.
And that's what we have to look forward to. You just talked about the two guys in the sideline. You're going to have John Kiely v Derek Ling, Nicky Quaid v Owen Murphy, and then go with the rest of them against each other. It's going to be epic.
Greatest sport in the world. It is. There is nothing like it. Fellas get up on horses there and should run emozying around the place and lads kicking the, kicking a bit of leather around the place. But this is real sport. And it's just it's something really to whet the appetite. And look, they are the two best teams in the country. Results in both league and championship dictate that. And again, as I said last a couple of weeks ago, it reinforces the nature of our championship. But it's just so exciting. And look, again, the man in the middle is going to be a crucial call. I know my Clare brethren, they have a lot of kind of disgruntled members today talking about the refereeing performance yesterday. And look, in real time, I would have thought that Clare were harshly outdone, and none more so than the goal attempt. I just couldn't really understand it in real time. So the one thing I suppose you do hope is that for the guy who does get the call to go in the middle, that you wish him all the best, but that he doesn't become a focus of attention thereafter, because it's incredibly difficult to get every decision right when you're a player or a manager, but 10 times more so when you're a referee, when one side will all dictate that you're wrong. So that's what we have to look forward to in the next couple of weeks.
Niall, on a serious note though, when you do speak about the referee and how important he's going to be in an All-Ireland final, with the pace of hurling, with how the game has developed, with how it has progressed over time, do we need two referees? Is it fair to expect one person to cover a pitch that's 145 metres long with a ball moving at the pace it's moving?
The reality on the ground, Ruby, here is we play a lot of schools games here, play a lot of underage games. It's the same couple of referees on the ground level who are refereeing everything. And an interesting observation I just had was a particular guy who was working his job that facilitated refereeing a lot of schools games, but he just said, like, if he refs the championship game here on Friday, he has two linesmen. But he, in turn, over the course of the weekend, would have to return that favour of standing on the sideline. And so what you're faced with there on the ground level is there's such a lack of referees right throughout the country. So if we're enforcing something whereby we now have a second referee, we're straight away halving the quota that's already so well short. What is the solution around it? I personally feel that your linesmen, it's not enough to have two qualified referees just standing the line and making... Look, they do more than just signal line balls. They obviously watch for what's going on. But with the amount of things that are going off the ball, do you know what I mean? I do think that maybe, is it a case that your lines then need to step in field a little bit more, whereby they're present some way on the pitch without getting in the way? And that's quite difficult in a game like hurling where the ball moves so fast, but whereby they're not negating space. And I personally think that let's try and use our linesmen a little bit better when we have them, if they are qualified referees. Can we take some of the pressure off the referee itself? Okay, and that way then is you're not making a fundamental shift in how games are governed at lower levels, which I just spoke about. You can still have these referees who are doing linesmen at club games. They can still stand in field and just be a bit more omnipresent, in the sense that there's so much going on that the referee isn't privy to. Lads being pulled, dragged, belted. But if you have a presence a little bit more in field, then there is a lot more of a deterrent there. That, to me, as it stands, is the only way around it. And look, could you argue at inter-county level, do they need a little bit of extra assistance? Yes. How we can practically facilitate that, I'm not quite sure. In a situation recently where you had the Hawkeye not able to work amidst critical games, do we have the consistency at GAA level, the grassroots level, to implement anything more than just using your linesman better, I'm not quite sure. But definitely, they do need more. And look, Callum Lyons, he didn't have his greatest game, but look, there was decisions that Clare people went nuts at that were fair decisions too when they look back on it, but also there was a lot of decisions whereby they'd have to feel aggrieved by him. When you put in so much and the margins are so small, it's very, very hard to take. So, yeah, I do have sympathy for the man in the middle. I wouldn't jump at the prospect of the job myself.
Certainly not. I think Barry Kelly was on the RTGA podcast as well, saying about, you know, we want consistency and how consistent would it be with two referees with perhaps differing viewpoints. But however, it will be interesting to see what course that takes. My final one for you, Niall, just on the hurling itself, considering how much we are looking forward to this final, could Limerick-Kilkenny become the tip Kilkenny rivalry that we've seen in 09, 10, 11 perhaps now, considering it's two in a row All-Ireland finals?
I think that's what we're looking at. It looks like 9 and 10, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like 9. It has the makings of it, I suppose. It's kind of, as I said, a lot of things are kind of being mirrored. And I often wonder, you know, when you're younger and you're seeing these horror films where the scientist is inside in the laboratory and he kind of he rattles a few chemicals together and he makes this monster that he can't control. And this monster goes on to, you know what I mean, knock down cities and towns and everything else. I think, is it a case that Kilkenny have inadvertently created a little mini monster in Limerick? Because whether you like it or not, we are mimicking everything that Kilkenny have done. And just look, I know not when I say mimic it, that's not being disingenuous what we've done, but all the core principles that Kilkenny have adopted, their ability to be so extraordinary and what they do in the ordinary, their ability to conduct themselves on and off the pitch, do you know what I mean, the honour in which they carry themselves, they're all principles that Limerick have really engaged in. And I just think that's why I do think it's kind of a mirror image of what happened in 9 and 10, because Tipperary at that point took a lot of their leaf from what Kilkenny were doing, overwrite them. And I definitely think the same is true again. But Camara is one team that will really want to knock Limerick more than all the rest and think they want to knock them, Kilkenny. And if our neighbours across the border in Clare, Tip, Cork were sick of listening to us, well, I tell you, we have the lads over in the north side that are equally so, because when it comes to hurling, it's their game, and they don't like to see anybody else take their limelight, and that's why 2 weeks time there won't be a seat in the house, there won't be a milker to be got in either of the counties for a couple of days if they win it. But it's exciting times. The only negative, July the 24th, and that's inter-county hurling at senior level finish for the year, which is probably why we have this conversation for another day. You'd love for it to go on another month, but for now it's with Limerick and Kenny. We're both thrilled that we're last man standing.
Absolutely. Well, it will be.
What's rare is beautiful.
What's rare is beautiful indeed, Ruby. I cannot wait for that cracker in a couple of weeks. Listen, Niall Moran, thank you very, very much. Pleasure as always. Ruby, we're going to be chatting to Alan Colley after a break, because he is waiting patiently here as always.
Game on.
Football.
Well, welcome back to Game On, where we are going to talk soccer or association football, as my trusty comrade Shane Dawson likes to call it. But Alan Colley, you've had 20 minutes while we were talking to Niall Moran. Any word from Ian Foster?
He's coming on next week, Ruby.
That wasn't what we sent you off to find out. Is he going to Saudi Arabia, and is Wilfred Zaha going to join him? They were the two jobs we set you.
Okay, well, one out of two ain't bad. So he's going to Saudi Arabia, but he's coming back to me on Zaha.
Apparently, BBC are reporting Zaha asked too much money, Ruby. He asked for too much money in Saudi Arabia.
If you probe a little bit, so he was in touch with Ian Foster.
Mm. Well, I do know him. I worked with him.
We're not doubting that. We only want a few answers after, man.
But I have to say, when Shane announced that surprised me, because I saw his post earlier, and he's been involved with the FA for the last, as I say, 6 years, and been involved as an assistant manager, as a coach. Then he managed the under-19s and was successful as well. So it must have been a huge offer, and obviously with the Saudi Arabia offers the way they are at the moment, and then the fact that if it's going in with Steven Gerrard, the opportunity to work with him as well. He's from Liverpool also, so I'm sure there was a relationship struck up there over the years. So yeah, big opportunity for him, but a surprise.
Surprised Alan Colley. What about David De Gea? He's no surprise that he's moving on. 18.9 million he cost Manchester United in 2011 from Atletico Madrid. Premier League, FA Cup, Europa League, 2 Carabao Cups, 4-time United Player of the Year, and 2 Premier League Golden Gloves. Will he be hard to replace or not?
No, I don't think so. And obviously the CV is good when you read it out like that, but I think...
No, that's what took me back when I was reading it as well.
Yeah, I think there's better goalkeepers. He's been a good servant, don't get me wrong. Anyone that stays at a club as big as Man United for 10 years, 11 years, and he has been a good servant. But he never struck me as one of, like, if you were to ask me a question, who's the best goalkeepers or who have been the best goalkeepers?
Schmeichel.
Obviously number one.
Czech. Czech's better than Schmeichel.
And some great ones over the years. And you look at the Liverpool and Ederson. You look at Alisson at Liverpool. Ederson, I don't think, is in that category yet. I think Alisson is. But De Gea is well down the pecking order for me. I actually think the lad that they're going to sign to replace him is a better goalkeeper. Onana.
Andre Onana.
Yeah, I think he's good, Ruby. And then again, I suppose this might irritate a few people, but the modern day goalkeeper, obviously they want him to play out from the back, and he's excellent at that. But you'll ask the question, is he a good goalkeeper? Because I know you're one of those that just wants a goalkeeper to save
bit,
the ball.
To me, like a bit like a defender. How many touches did he have? I don't care. How many defended he was marking score. Yeah.
And I'd be with you as well on that, Ruby. You know, if you're a goalkeeper, you're there to save the ball and keep it out. Obviously they want them to be skillful in other areas as well, in terms of his distribution, which is fine. But I think first and foremost you have to be a good goalkeeper, and he is. Onana is.
Can I ask who is the best Premier League goalkeeper in your eyes, Alan?
Ever?
Yeah.
Schmeichel.
Oh, okay.
And you let him away with saying Czech. I couldn't believe
Peter
it.
Peter Czech's better goalkeeper.
I didn't even hear it.
Czech.
I was thinking.
No,
Czech. I knew you hadn't.
Czech was good, but he wasn't as good as Schmeichel, Shane. Schmeichel was the best.
Most clean sheets in Premier League history, Peter Czech. 202 clean sheets.
Sorry. Anyone that goes to Google for an argument.
Sorry,
You have to remember though, he was playing behind Steve Bruce and Gary Pallister.
Yeah, no, Schmeichel was the best.
Decent centre half, Ruby, with respect to Steve Bruce and Gary Pallister.
Decent, but weren't overly quick now either of them.
No, and Czech was playing behind Terry and Carvalho and great players, and Mourinho was negative in the way he set up and all that kind of crack.
Okay, well listen, we've a couple of minutes left. So Onana is probably going to be replacing David De Gea. League of Ireland football. Of all things, I've lost my notes. League of Ireland football. Rovers dropped points away to Drogheda. Cork broke Pat's hearts with Rory Keating's last minute equaliser. Both came from behind to defeat Dundalk. Two goals in the last 10 minutes to win 3-2. Last minute penalty for Derry defeated Sligo 2-1. Shells had a somewhat convincing 4-0.
Did you write this? Shells made hard work of their 4-0 win. Shay, come on.
He's even struggled to write it.
He actually wrote this down, Ruby.
You know he wrote down lies. I'll tell you what's more interesting about the League of Ireland. Rovers tomorrow night playing...
Go on, Ruby.
The Icelandic champions.
Yeah.
Whose name? Breidablik.
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 Yeah.
Breidablik. Breidablik.
I'm glad...
What sort of an impression can Rovers make on European football? Come on, Colin Colley. You're champion the League of Ireland here.
Well, I always champion it, Ruby, and I think they can make a good impression. Obviously, the way things have gone over the past 3 or 4 years has been good for them, and I think with the financial rewards that are on offer now for all the clubs, it's such a key time for them because there's serious money to be made and serious finance. Rovers obviously going down the Champions League route, it's the best route to be in, Ruby, because even if you lose, you drop down to the Europa League. You lose in the Europa League, you drop down to the Conference League at an advanced stage. So it's all in their favour to get to a group stage. That will be the expectation. They want to get back there. They didn't do themselves justice last year because they were still, I suppose, fighting on 3 or 4 fronts in terms of the league and the cup, and they wanted to concentrate on that, and they were going into games playing under or weakened teams, if you like. So I think Stephen Bradley has more of an emphasis and more of a focus on the fact that they want to make a good fist of it again this year and get to that group stage and then make a good fist of the group stage. The only issue I have with them, Ruby, at the moment is the fact that you look at the league table. You mentioned there, Shane did, about them dropping points again Friday night against Drogheda. Their form is patchy, to say the least. And if you think of the 75 points that have been on offer so far, they've dropped 28 points already. Like, 28 is a lot of points when you think, and yet they're still 4 points clear and comfortable. And one of the arguments I always make here about it is that I don't think they're being tested enough here, and they're winning games in second and third gear and sometimes dropping points in second and third gear. Come tomorrow, you won't get away with that, especially at this level that they're playing at tomorrow. But I also think that will bring them on a level because they'll have to raise their game, and when they turn it on, I think there'll be a match for most of the teams in the earlier rounds, and I think they'll get the job done.
That game is live on RTE2 at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow night. Stephen Bradley wants to sell out 7,000 people in Tallaght. Will he get it?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I definitely think there'll be a huge crowd at that, and huge interest as well. The good thing about the Champions League at this stage for the teams, Ruby, and the Europa League, it gets national recognition, so that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely. Here's hoping for a big crowd. Jack Byrne, Alan Manus, Gary O'Neill, Lee Grace could all feature as well, which is a big boost for Rovers. Sinead, that's all we have time for. Big thanks to Ronan Lawler, our producer, Laura Lee Davis, our broadcast coordinator, to Alan Colley. Thank you for popping in. Ruby, thank you very much, as
cheers,
always.
Shane. Talk to you tomorrow.
Better De Silva. Yes, you will indeed talk to me tomorrow, and we'll talk to our listeners tomorrow from 6. Better De Silva's up next, but from all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.